There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that.
This is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, 1207 FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile on this Tuesday. Glad to have you along. Live local talk over the hour and next hour as well. By the way, next hour, Sheriff Sam Cochran joins us. The conversation we do once a month, your chance to ask the sheriff. Got questions of Mobile County Sheriff Sam Cochran? Well, you can ask him coming up next hour. So in the 1 o'clock hour, he joins us. At 1230 today, a little after 1230 today, Dr. Alex Beebe with the University of South Alabama from the Geology Department joins us to talk about the 2 and 3 day earthquakes reported around Flomington and Century, Florida, Flomington, Alabama, Century, Florida area, and the fault lines that actually do exist in our area. We've talked about this back at the end of last year when we had that quake that was in North Alabama into East Tennessee, and now we've had some right here in our own backyard. We'll talk about that with Dr. Alex Beebe coming up at around 12:35. So we got some questions, interest in what caused, you know, the stuff in the China cabinet to rattle. Can you believe it? Earthquakes here in the southeast. We'll get into that coming up in just a little bit. And weather-wise, if you have not stepped outside, I had a second earlier, walked out to my truck, and man, it is gorgeous. 72 and sunny right now. A little bit of a breeze out there. Although this is the thing, that is spring break time, right? If some of the schools are on spring break, which I've heard a story, and I think maybe we have an update from Devin coming in, from Devin Walsh from News 5. She may have the story. Like, they arrested 115 kids at one time. Where's, oh yeah, it's, I don't think that was here. I think that was like over in somewhere across the line in Florida. Yeah, Okaloosa County. Yeah, there it is. Northwest Florida, 115 underage drinking arrests already made in Okaloosa County this spring break. It is kind of weird on days like today when it's not real hot. It feels great out there, but that I guess if you're coming from northern places, it feels like spring, so they come down here and enjoy it and get arrested. So welcome, spring breakers. We need the revenue. Thank you for being here. We'll go ahead and have a good time, and then you'll be arrested. All right. And it's important. It's a way, you know, how the planet works. We talk about it in hurricanes with staff meteorologist Dr. Bill Williams, that it's the balancing out of the planet, you know, constantly yin and yang, that kind of idea and concept. You get a lot of heat and energy at the near the equator, and it transmits to northern regions via hurricane. Well, same thing here. If you've got a bunch of money up somewhere else, and we would need that money, want that money down here because we need it to be able to pay gas tax going forward, we need you down here getting arrested and leaving your money down here. So we appreciate it. We appreciate it. Also, it is happy birthday time. We're going to talk about that in just a second. Happy birthday to the internet. Internet turning 30 today. Internet doesn't look a year over 15 to me, but it is a birthday. And we're going to go through a timeline. Pretty interesting. Live Science put up a timeline of the internet from the first connectivity between two computers to where we stand today. We'll run through that list coming up in just a little bit. All right, so all that on the way this hour right here on FM Talk 106.5. So we got happy birthdays, we got earthquakes, we got the sheriff. Let's see here, this breaking news, and we'll get more on this, I'm sure, in the update coming our way from News 5. But there was a deadly morning as a three dead in a Mobile murder-suicide. This reported from Shelby Banks over at WKRG.com. This is an update from MPD. Police found three people dead in a home. Do we need to give the address? I mean, it's fine public information. By the way, it's like a Sunshine Week with the Alabama broadcasters. We're all celebrating Freedom of Information Act, and I believe in all that stuff, but sometimes I choose not to. Well, I'm not going to give the address. But it's three people dead, all related. call came in about 9:15 this morning. Police responding to the scene after receiving a shots fired call. So right now there's no word on who. They said murder suicide. We don't know. You know, who did what at this point, but there'll be more, I'm sure, coming out from MPD. All right. Oh, and before we even get into the internet section, I do want to talk about this story I saw pop up about the online quizzes. I've been tempted in the past, but not fallen for the online. You know, Facebook will pop up an online quiz. You know, what kind of dessert topping are you, or what, you know, do you have royal blood, or what would be your spirit animal, or some ridiculousness like that? And then you get tempted, right? You go answer these questions and it tells you that you would be sprinkles, or you'd be toffee, or whatever. I'm just guessing. I think I'd be toffee. So now Facebook is suing makers of those online quizzes, saying the test, those tests online were actually just a ploy to hack tens of thousands of accounts. It says the quizzes ask broad questions like, do you have a royal blood? What is the color of your aura? Hey, Dalton, what is the color of your aura? Do you know? I am ignorant to the color of my aura. I do not. If anybody can see my aura, please let me know what color it is. I think it's crimson, probably. Facebook claims in a lawsuit filed recently that the quizzes were created by two Ukrainian developers and used to gain access to private user data without user knowledge. In the lawsuit, Facebook claimed the hackers accessed things like names, ages, photos, and the private list of Facebook friends. You starting to get a little worried here? You take part in some of these? Experts recommend that it's wise to Google any game, article, or quiz separately before clicking a link in your newsfeed. Aha, get another source on that. Remember, that's good in everything. Social media users say they were surprised to learn about the allegations, and I guess Facebook was too, and they're doing I guess they're acting surprised. I would say this, that There's some of these that are scams like this, or they're using this information to hack. And there's some of them out there that are just using the information you give in one of those quizzes to market. Remember, nothing is free. I mean, Facebook doesn't run on smiles, right? Yeah, the in-bed ads and all that, but the data. You go to websites where you can get a free version and all that. There's a reason, and it's okay. It's all in the up and up if you realize what they're doing is they're getting your information. They're getting demographics. They're getting buying patterns, things you've clicked on before, what you're interested in. Same reason ag and, ag equipment and boots follow about everything on the computers here at the station that I use. I'm followed by my places I've gone and looked online. And same thing happens on these sites. So some of these quizzes, Facebook is suing, saying they were direct hacking operations. Others, you'll see, they're getting your information. They're not going to hack you in so much as they're just going to gather the data on you. And I know it seems like a very thin line, a very gray place in between the two, but there is a little bit of a difference. So Facebook going after the people that are using it to get into your other accounts, hack and do nefarious things there, versus those that are getting your information and then packaging the info about people like you and like me and selling it to marketers out there. So there's a little bit of a difference yet between the two. So you understand. All right, coming back, we'll talk about the birthday of the internet. 30 years old for the internet. And the timeline, we'll get into that coming up in just a second. Plus, right after 12:30, we'll be talking to Dr. Alex Beebe with the University of South Alabama. Two earthquakes in 3 days in our area. What's it all about? We'll get into it coming up. Y'all stay close.
Is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5, Tuesday edition of Midday Mobile. Yeah, beautiful for today. Rain moving into our forecast. We'll get more from Dr. Bill coming up in just about 12 minutes with Our exclusive update from him. All right, Ed, thank you for the email on this, John. And John said, hey, the internet is 50 years old. You may want to check on that to be sure. Aha. So this is what makes this whole discussion pretty interesting, is when you think the internet started. And there's I love it because there's nuance within nuance on this. So the difference between the 50-year-old World Wide Web and the 30-year-old depends on HTTP. At least that's the debate I've heard. I'm just the two debates I hear is it started with the first connectivity between the two computers, which would, of course, make it like 50 years old, or when they started using the hypertext transfer protocol, right, HTTP, that adorns a web address. So they said that's a building block for the web. The HTTP system allowed text and small images to be retrieved through a piece of software, which was the first browser. So there's the difference between the people that say it's 50 and people that say it's 30. But let's do this. Let's go back. Live Science put out this list I thought was pretty neat, kind of a timeline here. And so, yeah, you can go back. We'll go back to 50 years ago. They say credit for the initial concept that developed into the World Wide Web is typically given to Leonard Kleinrock. In 1961, he wrote about ARPANET, am I saying that right? A predecessor of the internet, in a paper entitled Information Flow in Large Communication Nets. Kleinrock, along with other innovators such as J.C.R. Licklider, the first director of Information Processing Technology Office, provided the backbone for the ubiquitous stream of emails, media, Facebook posts, tweets, all that stuff. All right. So a brief history here of the internet. So the precursor to the internet was jump-started in the early days of computing history. In 1969, with the U.S. Department of Defense's Advanced Research Projects Agency Network, which is what they used in Vietnam a lot, too. They used this information that Pentagon would put all the information for body counts and munitions and what we had on site and what we thought the NVA had on site and the Viet Cong. And they would like almost run simulations in this computer to figure out who would win. There's a whole fascinating discussion about what they were doing with Vietnam and computing back then. But it says here in this timeline from Live Science, 1965, two computers at MIT Lincoln Lab communicated with each other using packet switching technology. All right, so that's 65. 68, Baranek and Newman, you hear the Baranek name a lot when you talk about the web, unveils a final version of Interface Message Processor, IMP specifications, and BBN, their company, wins the ARPANET contract. 1969, on October 29th, UCLA's Network Measurement Center, Stanford Research Institute, University of California, Santa Barbara, and University of Utah install nodes. Okay, so I guess communicate where they're connecting these computers. The first, listen to this, the first message on the web. Ain't much change here. The first message on the web was L-O. L-O, the letter L, the letter O, which was an attempt by a student, Charles Klein, to log in to the SRI computer from the university. However, the message crashed the server. The system crashed, and they only got L-O typed through before the system crashed. Like I said, not much changes, huh? 1972, great year. BBN's Ray Tomlinson introduces network email. The interworking working group forms to address needs for establishing standard protocols for the system. A year later, in 73, global networking becomes a reality as the University College of London and the Royal Radar Establishment in Norway connect to this ARPANET, and the term internet is born. So 1973, they first used the term internet. 74, the first internet service provider is born. How about that? First ISP, 1974, introduction of a commercial, so a civilian version of ARPANET, known as Telenet. 1974, Vinton Cerf and Bob Kahn, duo said by many to be the fathers of the internet, publish, quote, a protocol for packet network interconnection, end quote. I'm sure it was a page turner, which details the design of TCP. 1976, get this, Queen Elizabeth II hits send on her first email. 76, the Queen sent an email. 1979, Usenet forms to host news and discussion groups. Okay, so as early as 79, we're talking about Saturday Night Fever, right? Didn't that come out in 79? I think so. Disco and disco movies were a big thing, and they were forming Usenet. 1981, National Science Foundation, NSF, provided a, not national security, NSF, provided a grant to establish a computer science network, CSNet, to provide networking services to university computer scientists. 1982, TCP, Transmission Control Protocol, and Internet Protocol, IP, think about these terms now we still use, as the protocol suite, commonly known as TCP/IP, emerged as a protocol for ARPANET. In other words, this is the language we still use online. This results in fledgling definition of the Internet as a connected TCP/IP internets. Yes, in plural, TCP/IP remains standard protocol for the Internet. 1983, DNS. So domain name system established is pretty familiar. You'll recognize all these. .edu, .gov, .com, .mil, .org, .net, and .int systems for naming websites. This is easier to remember than the previous designation of websites, such as a long string of numbers. We won't even read that. 1984, William Gibson, author of Neuromancer, is the first to use the term cyberspace. 84. Then in 85, Symbolics.com, the website for Symbolics Computer Corporation in Massachusetts, becomes the first registered domain. So the oldest place on the web, is it still up? I'm going to have to hit that here in a second. Symbolics.web, S-Y-M-B-O-L-I-C-S, Symbolics.web, the first website. 1986, National Science Foundation's NSFNet goes online to connect supercomputer centers at 56,000 bits per second, the typical speed of a dial-up computer modem. Oh, don't we remember those? 1987, a number of hosts on the Internet exceeds 20,000, and Cisco, obviously a big player in this, ships its first router, 87. 89, world.std.com. It was STD, becomes the first commercial provider of dial-up access to the Internet. 1990, that's what, 89-90 is when I first got online. And Tim Berners-Lee, a scientist at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, develops hypertext markup language, HTML. We're still using it. Technology continues to have a large impact on how we navigate and view the web today. 1991, CREN introduces the World Wide Web to the public. 92, the first audio and video are distributed over the Internet. The phrase surfing the Internet becomes popularized in 1992. 93, now watch this, we're starting to get some rocket fuel on this. 93, the number of websites reaches 600. And the White House and the United Nations go online. Mark Andreessen develops Mosaic Web Browser. I remember that. At University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, the number of computers connected grows from 2,000 in 85 to more than 2 million by 1993. 1994, this is going to be a flash in the... You remember this one. Netscape Communications is born. Remember Netscape? And this company, Microsoft, creates a web browser for their Windows 95. 1994 as well, Yahoo is created by Jerry Yang and David Filo, two electrical engineering graduate students at Stanford. The site was originally called Jerry and David's Guide to the World Wide Web. The company later was incorporated in March of 95, and those men made some money. CompuServe in 95, America Online, and Prodigy began to provide internet access. Amazon.com, Craigslist, and eBay go live. 1995 for Amazon, Craigslist, and eBay. Think about this. Those were three domineering places on the web, and they were all about selling stuff and buying stuff. 1995 as well brought on the first online dating site. Yeah, y'all, Match.com was launched in 95. In 96, the browser war, primarily between two major players, Microsoft and Netscape, heated up. CNET buys TV.com. The website TV.com went for $15,000 in 96. Also, 3D animation named Dub Dancing Baby became the first viral video in 96. Netflix is founded by Reed Hastings and Mark Randolph as a company and sends users DVDs by mail. In 1997, Netflix popped up. Think about these players we're talking about here. Also in 97, PC makers can remove or hide Microsoft's internet software on new versions of 95. Thanks to a settlement with the Justice Department, Netscape announced that its browser will be free. Then in 98, next year, Google is born. So kind of a late player there, right? Google search engine's born. 1998 as well, the Internet Protocol version 6 introduced to allow for future growth of internet addresses. The current most widely used protocol is version 4. IPv version 4 uses 32-bit addresses, allowing for 4.3 billion unique addresses. IPv6 with 128-bit addresses will allow for 3.4 times 1,038 unique addresses, or 340 trillion, trillion, trillion. Addresses. 99, AOL buys Netscape. Peer-to-peer file sharing becomes a reality as Napster, hey Dalton, Napster, arrives on the internet in 99, much to the displeasure of the music industry. 2000, the dot-com bubble burst. Websites such as Yahoo and eBay are hit by large-scale DNS attacks or denial-of-service attacks, highlighting the vulnerability of the internet. And AOL at that point did its merger with Time Warner. Then in 2001, a federal judge shuts down Napster, ruling it must find a way to stop users from sharing copyrighted material before it goes back online. Okay, we'll pick this up. 2003, the SQL slammer worm spreads worldwide in just 10 minutes. MySpace, Skype, and Safari web browsers debut. 03 was MySpace. Also in 03, a blog publishing platform WordPress was launched. And in 04, something pretty big happened out there in the world of the web, and we'll talk about that when we come back next, right here on Midday Mobile. So, happy birthday, Internet.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 1234, FM Talk 106.5. Let's wrap this up because we've got to get to our interview with Dr. Alex Beebe. But I wanted to point out Facebook goes online as of 2004. Era of social networking begins. Mozilla unveils Mozilla Firefox browser, which I have a love-hate relationship with. Also in 05, YouTube launches. Social news site Reddit, also founded in 05. 06, AOL changes its business model, offering most services for free and still remaining friends of mine and family. Friends still have the at AOL.com. web address, which I dropped years ago. Couldn't do it. 2006, how about this? Dorsey and company over at Twitter launched. 2006 for Twitter. 2009, the internet marked its 40th anniversary. 2010, Facebook reached 400 million active users as of 2010. And 2010, the bane of my existence because I once signed up for it and I can't get rid of it. Pinterest. Social media site Pinterest was launched. Also Instagram, the IG, which is pretty cool. That was 2010. Think about how fast it's moving here in the latter part of this. 2011, Twitter and Facebook play a large role in Middle East revolts. 2012, former President Obama's administration announces its opposition to major parts of the Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect Intellectual Property Act, which would have enacted broad new rules requiring internet service providers to police copyright content. Successful push to stop the bill involving technology companies such as Google and nonprofit organizations, including Wikipedia, which was actually partially founded by a guy from North Alabama, and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, considered it a victory for these sites such as YouTube that depend on user-generated content. 2013, Edward Snowden, former CIA employee and National Security Agency contractor, and I'll add in guy that is looks like, unless I find out something new, a traitor to the United States, revealed the NSA had a place in monitoring a program in place monitoring U.S. communications of thousands. All right, 2013, 51% of U.S. adults report that they bank online. 2015, Instagram photo sharing site reaches 400 million users. 2016, Google unveils Google Assistant, a voice-activated personal assistant program marking the entry of the internet giant into the smart computerized assistant marketplace. So there you go. Google joining Alexa from Amazon and Siri from Apple, Cortana from Microsoft. Microsoft. So there you go. So some of the brief history of the internet, and I think it's pretty interesting. So it could, you could say it's 50 years old today-ish or 30 years old. I mean, there's an argument to be made on both sides, but either way, it's time to stop down and pay attention to this thing that has changed so much in so many lives so very, very quickly. All right, coming up after the break, we're talking earthquakes. The report was the one yesterday afternoon was 3.1. Centered near Flemington and Flemington, Alabama, home of the Flemington Auction. What's up, Flemington? And also Century, Florida, that area. There's also one in that same area just a few days ago. And we'll talk to Dr. Alex Beebe from the University of South Alabama Geology Department about that. Fault lines in our area. Could we feel more earthquakes around here? What's the sort of, I mean, you don't think about the Southeast as being any kind of area with, you know, seismic activity. But, I mean, in fact, we have seen late last year and then a couple times this year some seismic activity. So we'll talk about that when we get back right here on Midday Mobile. This is FM Talk 1065, online at fmtalk1065.com.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 1065.
Welcome back, FM Talk 1065 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along, and good to talk to Dr. Alex Beebe, Assistant Professor of Geology at the University of South Alabama. Again, last time I was bothering you, Dr. Beebe, we had a earthquake reported at what, northern Alabama, east Tennessee, that area, and now I'm ringing your phone again, man. Hey.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you again.
Yeah, you know, every time it shakes, right, I pick up the phone and call you. And first of all, yeah, tell folks what you do at South.
Well, at South, I teach hydrology classes and geophysics. So, you know, I'm either looking at water or I'm looking at earthquakes and other sorts of physical phenomena that take place.
Now, this would be one of these, there's a lot of people probably today, well, maybe more lately, that have woken up and said, oh, wow, we do get some tremors around here. But it's not ever been, you know, growing up, a thing we ever thought much about. Hurricanes, yes, other, you know, other storms, those kind of things. But the ground shaking beneath us, you know, the fault lines was not something we grew up thinking much about.
Yeah, that's right. Although, you know, there are a couple of faults that kind of extend through the area where these earthquakes have been occurring over the last week or so. So there are faults around us, and they're deep within the ground. It's just most of those faults are what we call dormant faults. They're not active. We're actually on kind of a passive margin between the plate that contains North America and then the oceanic plate that has the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic Ocean. So we should be a pretty quiet area. You know, passive, you think quiet, you think not a lot of earthquakes.
But I mean, I remember last time we talked about, you know, you got to go to the northwest a good bit. Back in the 1800s, though, the New Madrid fault line really had a big boom. There, I guess, a couple of them, one big enough to form a lake.
And that's the thing. These we call these intraplate earthquakes. So these are faults that are kind of stuck inside the continent that at one time probably formed as a result of a continental collision, maybe a mountain-forming event, or maybe an ocean-forming event. And so there are already fractures in the rock that are deep there. It just takes something, usually geologic time, for those faults to slip every now and then. But they're much more quiet now than they probably were in the geologic past. So in the case of the New Madrid Fault Zone, in the case of the earthquakes over at the Alabama-Florida line, you know, these earthquakes are not nearly as frequent. And what we see is just kind of settling that will take place. So we'll see the crust just kind of, over time, accumulate sediments on top and build up a little bit of load that eventually lets itself go and releases usually less frequent, smaller magnitude earthquakes. So just enough to get people talking, but you know, not typically big enough for us to see lots of damage.
When you say builds up a load before, is it coming from the top down, or is it actually these plates, are they rubbing together or banging together here like we kind of picture, you know, the Ring of Fire or other fault zones?
Well, at one time, it would be coming from below, as you described, by plate motions, and that's how these faults all formed. But now, you know, we don't have motion in our area. We're on, again, a passive margin, so there's no collisions taking place, there's no spreading. You know, we don't have any volcanic activity, which you typically associate with moving plate boundaries. So these formed, but now the pressure that would cause an earthquake is coming from the top. And in our case, we're building up massive amounts of sediment that are coming down through the Alabama Tongariro River system and the Mississippi River system to an extent, too, are dumping all of this sediment. And a good time right now, if you drive across the Bayway or the Causeway, sure. you'll see that sediment coming from a good portion of the state of Alabama, and it finds its resting place here on the Gulf Coast. So we're dumping all this sediment. We're putting a lot of weight kind of in our area, and that causes the crust to sag ever so slightly. In fact, here in Mobile, we're actually sinking at a rate of about a millimeter a year, so nothing that you would notice over the course of your lifetime. But, you know, that's pressure that's being put onto the crust. And if you find an area of weakness where there's a pre-existing fracture or a fault, then you may not have as much bending of that crust. It may not be as smooth, but you may have a more jarring motion, and you may have these sudden slipping events that's causing these earthquakes, we suspect.
It is an interesting concept for those of us that don't study this like you and have the education to think about enough sediment load being weight-wise to push down and, like you said, bow the crust. I got this idea this crust is this immovable object, but in fact, I guess it's not.
And well, the thing is, I mean, it's kind of like we're watching collisions, like a train crash in very slow motion. I mean, we talk about geologists, you know, we're playing with not, you know, tens of years, hundreds of years. We may be talking about thousands of years. We may be talking about millions of years of time. So this is, you know, think about the sediment that's coming right now and entering Mobile Bay and how cloudy the water is, and imagine that continuing on for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. That's a lot of sediment.
Sure.
In fact, we have several thousand feet of sediments that have accumulated in our area, and that's a lot of weight, a lot of pressure that's being put on the deep crust. And so the crust is accommodating that weight and kind of sinking as a result in our area. But there are places on Earth where we actually see the crust is rising. It's actually coming upwards, and I think Antarctica is a good example. We're losing ice, and this has been going on for the past 20,000 years or so, and as that ice has melted over time, there's less weight pushing down on the continent, and then it's actually starting to rise. It's actually coming up. So these are very, very slow processes for the most part that take place over what we call geologic time. But occasionally we see more rapid movement, and that's the case of the earthquake, where you're just building up load, you're building up stress, you're building up pressure until you finally hit the snapping point, the breaking point, the weakest link, and you get a sudden slippage that will cause these earth tremors and cause the earth to shake.
Just joining us, talking to Dr. Alex Beebe, geologist with the University of South Alabama. You mentioned like the New Madrid Fault Zone, and we hear about fault lines, and they have names. Does this area around here we're talking about, does it have a name? Is it named, or is it just part of another area?
Well, yeah, it actually does have a name. If you go to the Alabama Geologic Survey, if you're interested, you can actually see a map that has this seismic zone plotted. And they call it here, kind of on the broad scale, the Bahamas Fracture Zone. And so you have this long fracture, this long fault that extends through kind of the southern part of Alabama and then into Florida, and makes its way, if you extrapolate it from our area down to the coast of Florida, it makes its way towards the Bahamas, which is where it gets its name.
Wow.
But within that seismic zone, there are smaller portions where things get a little bit more detailed for us.
Anything that does it get your attention that there have been two? Now, these have 3.1. I don't know what the one was back on the 7th. These aren't major earthquakes or anything, but the fact that there have been two in three or four days?
You know, it's not uncommon to see swarms of earthquakes. So you know, we're thinking about this load has been building up for some time now. The last earthquake actually to take place in that area was back in 1997, and it was much larger. It was a 4.9 magnitude, which, just to put that in perspective, each number that you go up on the magnitude scale is an increase in energy of a factor of 10. So it was 100 times more shaking, in other words.
Y'all listen to that. Yeah, because I think people get lost in that, you know, the incremental versus logarithmic. Once again, the jump from 3 to 4 is how much?
From 3 to 4 would just be, so one whole number increase is a factor of 10. So if you go from 3 to 5, so it's 4.9, so about 5, that's 10 times 10, which would be 100.
Wow.
So you know... At that point, when you hit a magnitude 4.9, a magnitude 5, let's round it off, that's going to you know, everybody around is going to notice it. That's when you're going to start to see damage to structures, especially in this area where we may not be as prepared for an earthquake of that magnitude. But around 3, which is, you know, 3, and I think the one earlier a couple days ago was a 2.7, if I'm not mistaken. That's kind of at the boundary where people will start to notice. So you may, you know, notice things shaking. You may, if you have a lamp hanging from the ceiling, you may see it kind of shake around a little bit. You might, it's going to be rare, but you might hear rattling in your windows, and you'll probably say, you know, what was that? Did a truck just drive by? You know, did something heavy just roll by us? And if you're isolated and you don't see anything, then you'll probably start to ask questions that, you know, was that an earthquake? I'm not sure. But at a 5, magnitude 5, there's no question, there's no mistaking that something is wrong, something is going on for us here. So, yeah, back to your original question, you know, having these two earthquakes back-to-back, we're probably just building up pressure, and then you see a little bit of slippage in one area, and then the load shifts to another area along that fault, and if it's weak, it can let go as well. So, you know, a lot of times these earthquakes will come in swarms in a certain area, and we have 4 shocks, you know, preceding a major earthquake, and then sometimes aftershocks that take place as well. If that load kind of shifts around until it finally catches on that fault, then we can stop the movement. So, yeah, it's not, I guess it's not super surprising to see, you know, earthquakes, and there may be another one that's on the way, or maybe another few that are on the way. But, yeah, it kind of goes with that rebalancing that load and trying to reach a new equilibrium, and it'll probably stay locked up for some time until another set of earthquakes comes, you know, maybe in 10, 20 years.
You know, I've got to sneak in the back of one of your classrooms and take notes, because I've got the questions like thinking about the sediment load, and I can picture that absolutely building up. But, you know, you think about the sediment load in the bay or out in the Gulf where that is dumped. But then you have the center of this earthquake up in, you know, Flemington. I mean, you know, good bit inland. I mean, we're talking about right on the Alabama-Florida line up there.
Mm-hmm. And that area still has a lot of sediments on top of it as well. You know, we're a big basin here, we call it a sedimentary basin, where we're just accumulating sediments that are being washed from northern part of the state, from the Appalachian Mountains, and from high areas. And sea level has kind of moved around sometime, so it's been up in that area just recently, really. But if you think about, you know, just how much sediments that we have, that's one of the things that's responsible for all the oil and natural gas that we have in this area. We have these real thick layers of sediment that have been accumulating for millions and millions of years. And so that load is going to continue to be put in this area. So it's been building up for some time, in other words. So, you know, this is sediment that's been captured when sea level was higher in the past, and when sea level was lower as well. It kind of puts a regional stress in the area. So it doesn't have to be just right at the shoreline, in other words, the present shoreline.
Yeah, you answered that. That was my next question, talking about the oil and natural gas around here because of that sediment. What about, okay, so we have this epicenter of the earthquake being around Flemington. If there were this swarming effect, where you said there were, you know, maybe some associated, will they all be associated close to that area, or could there be one over here in Mobile County, or could there be one over in the Florida Panhandle? I mean, is there any kind of rule to that?
Well, the probability would be higher that it's going to be along those pre-existing faults and fractures that we know of. And, you know, there is a chance that there's some faults or fractures in our area that maybe haven't been mapped. You know, it gets kind of difficult to see what's happening underneath the ground, because it's not easy for us to explore down in the subsurface. We can't necessarily find these fractures or faults unless we drill a well or a hole down in the ground, and sometimes we have to look pretty deep, or we use some sort of imaging process. We can use seismic imaging techniques to look down into the subsurface. So I would say that if there was a major fault in our area, then, you know, there probably would have been earthquakes. You know, we'd probably see kind of the same level of activity. So we kind of have to go with the probability and say that, you know, there have been earthquakes there in the past. It's not totally uncommon for that Bahamas fracture zone to have earthquakes, so that's probably where you're going to see more earthquakes into the future. But that said, you know, there is a fault zone that's just north of us that goes through the upper part of the delta, and it's part of what's called the Mobile Graben, and it's a set of north-south running faults that kind of extend northwards towards this Bahamas fracture zone. But we haven't really seen much shaking associated with that. And we would have thought we would have had something by now if it's going to be, you know, an earthquake caused it. But it could happen at any time. I mean, it's a plane of weakness that it could let go. But I wouldn't suspect it anytime soon, just based on what we've seen.
All right, but before we wrap here, because I know you got a class to get to, but I, if somebody feels something, and of course I'm going to report, you know, I'm into it, so if we get any news, I'll report it here on the radio station. But if somebody in an isolated situation, like you mentioned, felt something, what's the best resource to go check if that was actually an earthquake or, you know, somebody happened to just drop a big slab of iron next door or something like that?
USGS is probably going to be the best source. They run a number of seismometers, and these are instruments that are very sensitive to any shaking in the ground. And the USGS, the United States Geological Survey, has a network of these seismometers all throughout the United States and actually worldwide, and they're constantly listening for any sort of vibrations. And so they have the most delicate instrument. They have an automated site that they run where you can actually see earthquakes that have occurred within the last 24 hours or within the last 7 days or 30 days, and they'll show you exactly where those earthquakes are coming from, and they'll plot the epicenter for us, and they'll tell us the magnitude as well. So that's probably the best, most reliable resource for you there is the United States Geological Survey. They're really good about getting that information out very quickly.
As always, I appreciate you taking time with us and talking more about earthquakes in our area, and I'll be checking back with you soon, maybe sooner than later. It just depends on, you know, the swarms, right?
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Always a pleasure, Dr. Alex Beebe from the University of South Alabama and the Earth Sciences Department. And we're coming right back. More of Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 12:57 FM Talk 106.5. Big thank you to Dr. Alex Beebe, University of South Alabama, Geology Department. So talking fault lines, it's not your fault. I figure there's a fault joke in there somewhere. Fault lines in our area. Kind of cool thing to think about, and it's not the first time we've ever had these rumbles reported around here, but it's worth noting and kind of looking into it, especially when you have 2 and 3 days time. It raises an eyebrow or two, so hopefully, and we'll get the doctor back on in the future to talk more about this. It's kind of neat, the way the sediment comes out of places like the Mobile Tensaw Delta, Mobile Bay, down the Mississippi River mouth, and what it does for how it forms the oil and natural gas, and then how that could actually make bulges and sinking and bulges in the floor of the Gulf. Neat stuff. All right, coming up, speaking of good stuff, next hour, our once a month, although we should start doing this more, but our once a month visit with Mobile County Sheriff Sam Cochran, your chance to ask the sheriff, coming up next hour right here on Midday Mobile. Y'all stay close. Phone number, text line 343-0106. 343-0106. We'll be right back.